Genesis 29:31 to 30:24, the 30th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 27, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last part of Genesis chapter 29, and then the first part of Genesis chapter 30. We are going to be looking at another messy domestic scene, one that we're going to have to sort through, and it's challenging to sort through it. I've made comments about this in the past, but that won't keep me from making comments about it again. Marshall McLuhan, who has written a lot on the media, has made the observation that there are what he calls hot media and there are what he calls cold media. Hot media is the kind of communication that requires a lot of activity on the part of the recipient. And he uses reading as an example of a hot medium. Cold media are those that don't require much on the part of the recipient. And he uses television as an example of that. And I remember reading in a story not too long ago that they studied brainwave activity in people who were watching television, and people watching sitcoms, their brainwave activity was less than one sleeping. So that's a cold medium. A hot medium is one that requires a great deal of activity for the recipient. And it seems to me that that same principle can be applied to different kinds of literature. Some literature is more demanding on the part of the reader, and other kinds of literature are less demanding on the part of the reader. The Old Testament narratives, I think, are particularly hot. They require a great deal of mental activity on the part of the reader to try to put things together, because it's so cryptic. All we have is the bare essentials of the story, and your mind has to go searching to figure out how to link things together, how to tie it together. And we are supposed to do that drawing upon two things. One is our understanding of the culture and times, and there are instances where that's a hurdle, that's an obstacle, where we just don't have that kind of cultural information. But the other thing, the other resource that we have to draw upon is just our knowledge of what it means to be a human being. And that's nice because that's much more universal. We all have an intense interest in that particular topic, one way or another. We all know what it means to be a human being. We know what drives us. We know what struggles we have. And that's very helpful because the Old Testament narratives are likewise dealing with human beings. Human beings that have the same kinds of struggles that we do, the same kinds of desires, the same kinds of motivations. And therefore, we can use that as a guide to help us to understand the very cryptic presentation that we find in the narrative itself. In today's story, we're going to be looking at Leah and Rachel, and they get into this competition. But I think it's helpful to look back in the section that we looked at last week at one verse that I would like to bring your attention to, because I think it plays a significant role in what we'll be talking about today. And that is verse 17 of chapter 29. It says, "And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face." So the narrator has drawn our attention to the fact that On the one hand, Rachel is drop dead gorgeous. She's beautiful of form and of face. Leah has weak eyes. That doesn't mean Leah has poor eyesight. It's just that her eyes are not distinctive. They aren't particularly attractive. So Leah is plain. I don't think she's ugly. She's just plain. So we've got these two sisters. One is beautiful and the other one is plain. And presumably, they have, Leah is the older one. Presumably, they have grown up together. And you can imagine the situation. Leah, or Rachel, has always attracted the attention. Things have gone her way because of her attractiveness. And Leah has been the one who has seen this, but she has not had the same experience. And as a result, I suspect that Leah has struggled with that all of her life, always being at the wrong end of the comparison between the two. She looks at her sister, everything goes well, at least seemingly. She looks at herself, and things just, she just struggles along. It never quite gets better. And now they have grown up. They are of marriageable age. Someone comes along, the stranger, and he desperately wants to marry Rachel. In fact, he wants to marry her so badly, he's willing to work 7 years for her. Leah is not engaged. There's no one who wants to marry her. And apparently, even these 7 years that Jacob is working, no one comes along and asks for Leah's hand in marriage. So she's older, and yet she's not attractive enough to get a husband. So, as you'll recall last time, we have this situation in which her father intervenes and he deceptively marries off Jacob to Leah rather than Rachel. Then when Jacob complains, Laban agrees to marry Rachel to him as well. So now it's this point in time where probably it's something that Leah was looking forward to, that time when she strikes out on her own. She has her own husband who's devoted to her. And yet, this comparison from the childhood is going to continue on to her married life. Now they're both married to the same man, but her husband really wanted to marry Rachel, not Leah. You can imagine, at least kind of imagine, the situation that she's in. So that's the background behind this story. Let's look at the first part in Genesis 29, verses 31 through 35. Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. So she named him Simeon. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons. Therefore he was named Levi. And she conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I will praise the Lord. Therefore she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing. So this first section, we see that the unloved one, God is very gracious to. this unloved one, God opens her womb and makes it possible for her to bear children. And she bears four children, all of them sons. And sons were particularly prized. So God has been particularly gracious towards Leah in this particular situation. Now, we have very little commentary as to what's going on. All we've got to go on is the names that are given to these children and the statements that are made with respect to each child. So let's piece this together as best we can. The first one is named Reuben. And Reuben literally means, see a son, behold a son. And what she exclaims when this child is born is, because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. Clearly, the thing that Leah craves is to be loved by her husband. She wants that specialness that is supposed to be a part of marriage. That intimacy, that relationship that's supposed to be a part of marriage. And she rightfully sees that this child that has come is really a gracious act on the part of God. And her hope is, now that I have borne him a son, maybe this means that God is going to act in my favor and he will change the way that my husband looks on me. That it will change my husband's attitude towards me. The second son, Simeon, it means hearing. And the statement that she proclaims is, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. So apparently, again, she sees this as a gracious act on the part of God. God has responded again, given her another son. Even more basis now for her husband to love her. So she's more expectant now than ever before. The third son, she names him Levi, which means attachment. And the statement with respect to him, now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. So it's been three sons now. God has been very gracious towards her. Surely now her husband's attitude towards her will change and he will begin to love her. I don't know if you have had this experience, I certainly have, of where you've prayed for something for a long time that you would like to see. There's some kind of log jam. There's some kind of situation that you want desperately to change, but you are powerless to change it. And you keep thinking, all it takes is God snapping his fingers, and this would be resolved. And you see something happen that appears to be God's activity, and you think, now it's going to happen. Now the log jam is going to break, and this whole situation is going to be transformed. And yet, it doesn't. It's just that one act on the part of God, but he has not chosen to completely change the situation. And that seems to be what Leah is experiencing here. She keeps thinking with each child, that'll do it. But with each child, it doesn't do it. Jacob's attitude towards her remains the same. A fourth child is then born. She names him Judah. And that means praised. And she says, this time I will praise the Lord, Yahweh. This time I will praise Yahweh. It's interesting here on this fourth child, it's as though she's resigned herself to the fact that Jacob's attitude towards her is not going to change. But she shifted and found consolation elsewhere. And that is in God's graciousness towards her. That nevertheless, God has indeed been gracious towards her. And she can focus on that. That's a very It seems to me that that's a very mature response on her part. Because she's now placing her hope where on a firm foundation. She's placing her hope in a place where it can be realized, as opposed to hoping constantly for her husband to change, because that may or may not happen. So it's a very mature response on her part, I think, finally. However, as we'll see, it's not a permanent transformation of Leah's character. And I think that's very human as well. I certainly can identify with being brought by God to a situation where I am able to see things clearly, see things from God's perspective and embrace that and say, yes, it is truly good, but a month or two later, lose perspective on it again. And Leah goes through that transformation. Then it ends this section saying, with a kind of cryptic statement, then she stopped bearing. And it doesn't say why, and we'll come back to this in just a minute. Okay, so the competition now is going to begin between Rachel and Leah. We'll read the first eight verses of the next chapter. Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister. And she said to Jacob, "Give me children, or else I die." Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God, who has withheld you from you the fruit of the womb?" And she said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, that she may bear on my knees, that through her I too may have children." So she gave him her maid Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob went into her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has vindicated me, and has indeed heard my voice, and has given me a son." Therefore she named him Dan. And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again, and bore Jacob a second son. So Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed." And she named him Naphtali. So Rachel is responding to this with jealousy, which is interesting because now we've reversed the situation that has probably existed the earlier part of their lives, in which Leah was jealous of Rachel's beauty. And now we have Rachel being jealous of Leah's fertility. Now, Rachel has been barren these years. It doesn't indicate how long Rachel has been childless, but apparently all of these children are being born in a relatively short time. Jacob is in Haran. After the marriage, he is in Haran 14 years. He works for the 7 additional years that he had agreed to, plus another 6. Maybe it's 7. Must be 7. It's 14 years total afterwards. So all of these children that are going to be described in the rest of this chapter are born apparently, except for possibly the last one, are born while they are still in Haran. So when it says Rachel has been barren all these years, Leah must start bearing fairly early, and the first 4 are probably born in the first 4 or 5 years of marriage. So all these years that Rachel has been barren is probably not a lot of years. It's that she has been childless for these first half dozen years. And she becomes jealous of Leah, and as is true of all of us, our first response when things go wrong is to find someone to blame. Who can I blame this, my problem, on? And Rachel accuses her husband, holds him account for it. and says, let's see, what did he say to her? Give me children or else I die. As if he has anything to do with it. I mean, there's no indication that he hasn't been sleeping with her. So beyond that, he's powerless. And so he's not actually to blame, but she's looking for someone to blame who can address the problem, who can somehow make things better. Anybody that she can appeal to make things better. And so she turns towards her husband. And she says, give me children or else I die. It is as if having children is a life or death issue. That having children has become equated with life for her. To live without children is death, is living death. So she blames someone who's not to blame, and she exaggerates. She gets things out of perspective. If you'll recall, that's what Esau did when Jacob took advantage of him and stole the birthright. Esau comes in, he's hungry, and he says, I've got to have some soup. And Jacob says, well, I'll be willing to give you some soup if you'll give me the birthright. And Esau says, well, what good would the birthright be for me, because I'm about to die? Well, he wasn't about to die. It was a gross exaggeration, but he had elevated soup on the level of life. Equated them. Rachel's doing a similar thing here. Jacob's response is to become angry. And he says, am I in the place of God? He rightly understands that it is God who has to change, who has to fix the problem. He is powerless to do so. But what should Jacob do in this situation? What should Jacob's response be? Well, he can look back at family history, because I was thinking about it. I don't know if infertility in females is genetically transmitted, but it is interesting that Sarah, who is from the family in Haran, Rebecca, and now Rachel all have problems with fertility. But what should Jacob do in this situation? Well, Abraham and Sarah faced a similar situation in which Sarah was childless late into her life. And as you will recall, as they faced that crisis, one of their course of action was for Sarah to give her maid to Abraham in order to build a family through her. And Rachel uses that same expression here. And they know how that turned out. And that did not turn out well, in a sense. That a child was born, but it caused friction in the family. And Hagar and Ishmael had to be sent away. He could look back at Isaac when Isaac and Rebekah faced a similar situation. Rebekah was childless. And what happened there? In that situation, Isaac appealed to God to open Rebekah's womb, and God did so. So what course of action should Jacob choose? Well, Rachel suggests, take my maid as your wife. The same course of action that Sarah had suggested. And Jacob accepts this expedient. So, Jacob sleeps with Bilhah, the maid, and has a child. The child is a son again. They're beating all the odds with all these sons in a row. She names Rachel names it Dan, which means vindication. And she makes the statement, God has vindicated me and indeed has heard my voice and has given me a son. So she is seeing the situation as though her childlessness is a wrong that has been done to her. And she's saying, now a child has been born to my maid. I am vindicated. I'm okay now. A second son is born, and Rachel names it Naphtali, which means wrestling. And her statement with respect to this is, with mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed. So here she's seeing it as this contest with her sister, this wrestling match with her sister. And now, because her maid has given birth to a second son, Rachel has been victorious. It seems to me that that's her approach here is rather inflammatory. She is clearly escalating this competition and kind of being in your face with respect to Leah. I remember when, in my first trip to the Soviet Union in Moscow, there was this huge neon sign just a little ways from Red Square. And it said, "We will conquer." And I always thought, that's a rather inflammatory sign. That it's in your face. It's kind of escalating the competition. And that's the approach that Rachel has taken here. And the result of this is it kind of changes Leah's perspective on things. She gets caught up into this competition and loses perspective, the perspective that she had earlier gained. Let's look at the next few verses, verses 9 through 13. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took her maid Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, "How fortunate." So she named him Gad. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, "Happy am I, for women will call me happy." So she named him Asher. So Leah then responds by giving her maid to Jacob, through whom to have children. And we see later in the chapter that she sees this as being a particularly praiseworthy action on her part. And it's not clear to me why that's the case. But in any case, she escalates the competition, responds at least in the competition, and her maid then bears two more sons. The first one is named Gad, which means fortunate. And she says her statement with respect to that is how fortunate she is. The second one is named Asher, which means happy. And she says, "Happy am I, for women will call me happy." Okay, then the last little scenario, verses 14 through 24. Now in the days of wheat harvest, Reuben went out and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. Then Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." But she said to her, "Is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also?" So Rachel said, "Therefore he may lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." When Jacob came in from the field in the evening, then Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." So he lay with her that night. And God gave heed to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, "God has given me my wages, because I gave my maid to my husband." So she named him Issachar. And Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will, here it says dwell, but I think it's better translated exalt or raise me up, because I have borne him 6 sons. So she named him Zebulun. And afterwards she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel, and God gave heed to her and opened her womb. So she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And she named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son. Okay, we have this scene. It happens in during the wheat harvest. We're talking May of the year. And Reuben, who apparently is old enough to be out and about, so he's probably between 4 and 6 or 7. So he's been out roaming around, and he discovers these mandrakes. I know very little about mandrakes, except what I read. And it says that they grow out of the ground with no stem, just the leaves coming out of the ground, and a fruit. It says the fruit the size of a nutmeg. So if only I knew how big a nutmeg was, I could tell you how big a mandrake is. But they were how big? Okay, the end of a woman's thumb. So a little smaller than that, presumably. But they were, in the ancient world, they were considered to be a source of fertility. Mandrakes, according to the folklore, encouraged fertility. So he has found these, has brought these back. Rachel sees them, and Rachel says, I've got to have those. We see Rachel's desperation coming out. She's willing to try anything. At this point, she would probably even respond to infomercials on television. So she's desperate. She wants to try anything now to have a child. Leah's response is interesting because it's uncharacteristic from what we've seen in the past from her. Leah's response is it a small matter for you to take my husband? And would you take my son's mandrakes also? Well, that's a strange statement to make, because it seems from the narrative up to now, if anyone could accuse anyone of taking Jacob as their husband, it would be Rachel accusing Leah. The only sense I can make of this is that, and when it goes on to talk about the agreement that's worked out, is that apparently Jacob has ceased to be sleeping with Leah. That's the only way I can make sense of this. And in that sense, Rachel has stolen Jacob's husband. Now, I don't know if Rachel has insisted that Jacob not sleep with Leah, or whether it's just a sense of solidarity between Jacob and Rachel that he's not sleeping with Leah. But presumably that's what's happening. And that could account for the verse we saw earlier where it said Leah stopped bearing children. It didn't explain why that was the case, why her fertility all of a sudden changed. And I suspect that that's a hint of what's happening here. So, if I'm right then, Jacob has stopped sleeping with Leah. Rachel wants these mandrakes, and the agreement is, Rachel says, well, you can sleep with Jacob if I can have the mandrakes. And Leah is in favor of such an agreement. So when Jacob comes home, Leah runs out to him and says, you have to come and sleep with me tonight, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And that term hired shows up in just a second here. Okay. So in this competition then, this is the point to which it has been reduced in a sense. the competition is quite fierce. Leah then conceives as a result of this and has this would be her fifth son. She names him Issachar, which means reward, and that's a word that's related to the word hired. And she says, God has given me my wages because I gave my maid to my husband. Now, this is the verse that I alluded to earlier. I don't know why she saw it as being praiseworthy, particularly praiseworthy, that she had offered her maid up to Jacob. That is not explained, and I can't figure it out. But here, she obviously sees it that way. Then she has another son, a sixth son. She names it Zebulun, which means exaltation. And she says, God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will, and I think the better translation is, will exalt me because I have borne him six sons. So we see that the competition has heated up to the point where Leah has been drawn into it and is very much engaged in this competition, as well as Rachel, and it has become a fierce competition and one that's destructive in the relationship between the two sisters. It goes on to say that Leah has had a daughter also, but it says afterward. It doesn't say after what. But presumably it means afterward, that is, after they're in Haran. But it has just thrown it in here because Dinah becomes significant later on in the narrative. But Dinah is the feminine form of the word Dan, and it too apparently means vindication. So Leah has reached the point where she sees herself as being vindicated. There's another reason, I think, why Dinah is mentioned here, and because it's the seventh child that Dinah has given birth to, and seven is a significant number. Seven rounds it out, its completeness. So Leah has fulfilled her full complement. She has a full family, a full sheath. Quiver, a full quiver is referred to later on in Scripture. But God then finally responds to Rachel and her childlessness. And Rachel gives birth, and she gives birth to another son. And this son she names Joseph. And it means, may he add, literally. And she says, may the Lord give me another son. And through the birth of this son, she says, God has taken away my reproach. Okay. And with that, it leaves off the competition, this competition that's been describing between the two sisters. This is kind of it's not a pleasant section of Genesis to read. You feel for both of the sisters, you feel for their heartache, you can identify with it, but you don't see them making good choices, which adds to the frustration. I would like to talk just a little bit about Rachel in light of this passage, then Leah, and then Jacob. There's a sense in which it seems to me that beauty is a curse. To be drop-dead gorgeous is not a good thing. I can remember reflecting upon that when I was younger. Not because I know from personal experience, but I've observed that, it was obvious when I was growing up that those who are beautiful, their lives are different. They are treated differently. There's a certain kind of respect. There's a certain kind of, there's attention paid to those that are beautiful. I can remember not too long ago reading an article in the paper about scientific research that was done that showed, that indicated that pretty girls in grade school get more attention than those who are not. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that, that is true. That does happen. That is a phenomenon. It's part of being human. But that attention isn't always good. I mean, if I remember when I was in high school, the most beautiful girls in high school, it looked to me like they were pestered to death. Almost. I mean, the attention was a kind of perverse kind of attention. And I often wondered, if you're really gorgeous, can you have normal friendships? I mean, it seems like it kind of taints all of your relationships. So it is a bit of a curse there, in a sense. It is a problem in a sense. But it is a problem in another sense as well. Rachel is beautiful, and I think that because of that, life has gone her way, or at least seemingly so. And it's because of her beauty. And as a result, there's a tendency to forget that beauty is a gift and to think that that beauty is inherently me, that it's just because I am a great person that things go smoothly, that this attention comes. And this is true not just with beauty, it's true of any kind of giftedness. There's a sense in which giftedness blinds us to the fact that it is indeed a gift, and we think that it is inherently me, and that things go better because of that gift, and because things go more smoothly, we're never forced to face into the issue of what's truly valuable. In the way that someone who struggles with that does have to face into it. Think of someone who, like Leah, who probably went to bed at night sobbing sometimes because she's not as beautiful as her sister and things don't go as well. And why me? Why am I plagued with this? And there's something really healthy about facing into that issue. Because the question is, what is really valuable? And from where does fulfillment really come, ultimately? On what can I really rely? On what can I really place my hopes? And anyone who has gone through that kind of struggle, I mean, I'm sure you've all faced that in one way or another. And you know that it boils down to a very important decision. Am I going to become bitter because I'm not gifted in some respect? Or am I going to come to the place where I realize that giftedness is just giftedness? And still, the most important things in reality are not denied me. The most important things in reality, the most important things that there can be, are a gift from God that is there for the taking, if I am willing to take it. My sense is that Rachel's never had to deal with that in the way that Leah has. So now she's facing her first major trial. Her beauty can't get her kids. And she's struggling with that and trying to get resolution. So, faced with this problem, she blames her husband. She becomes desperate. She becomes jealous of her sister. I mean, rather than rejoicing with her sister and her sister's good fortune, she becomes jealous. And she begins to look for fulfillment in the wrong place. Children become everything to her. If only I had a child, then everything would be right with the world. And she places all of her hopes there. But I think that in the end, there is an ever so slight hint that she's beginning to come around. She says after the birth of Joseph, she says, "May the Lord give me another son." And here she uses the name Yahweh. And I think that that is very significant because prior to this, Rachel has never used the name Yahweh. Leah has. Rachel has not. Rachel has always used the term Elohim. And Elohim seems to be a reference to the Creator God, whereas Yahweh seems to be a reference to the God of promises, the God who appeared to the patriarchs and made those promises. When the last time we looked, God came to Jacob, he said, "I am Yahweh," and then he blessed him. So here Rachel is now looking to the God of the promises. She nursed a great deal of bitterness and desperation. Leah. Leah is one who desperately wants to be loved by her husband. It's natural and right for a woman to want to be loved by her husband. But that is not our fulfillment. That love in a marriage, the kind of intimate relationship that marriage is designed for, that is not fulfillment. It may or it may not come in marriage. It's not the kind of thing that you want to build your life on, your eternal security on. You need to build your eternal happiness, you need a solid foundation. And the only thing that's solid enough for that is the promises of God. So she is another one who has elevated something that it's a good thing to want to be loved by your husband, but it is not the ultimate thing. And she has elevated it to a position that it ought not have. Now, in Leah, it appears as though she makes progress in coming to understand that, and then she gets wrapped up in the competition and loses sight of it again. A very human thing, as I've mentioned. Before I talk about Jacob, let me talk about a common thing to both Leah and Rachel. They are struggling to value things rightly. And that's a theme that we've seen in Genesis earlier. Esau had trouble valuing things rightly. It seems to me that it is the nature of faith, of a relationship with God in which we put him as master of our lives, that part of that is repenting of an understanding of what is important that is based on us being the center of the universe. A self-centered evaluation of what is important and what is not important. And what we're doing when we come to God is we say, "I reject all of that. I realize that's wrong. That the universe does not revolve around me. But rather the universe revolves around you and what you value. And that I want no longer to value what I used to value. I want to value what you value. I want to adopt your priority of values, of good things. I want to arrange those in the same order in my life. And not get things out of priorities." And that means coming to be a student of God and his creation, making it a passionate activity to come to a better understanding of how God would prioritize things, what he values and how greatly he values them, and to understand his ways and to want to live our lives in accordance with his values and in accordance with his ways. And what we've seen in Genesis is several instances in which people have gotten those priorities out of order. They have elevated something that is of ultimately very little value into a place that it ought not have, a place that rivals righteousness, that supersedes righteousness. In Rachel's case, she is elevated having children to a position that it ought not have. She thinks that life comes from having children. Very ironic in Rachel's case, because she dies giving birth to her second child. Leah, on the other hand, has elevated the love of her husband to a place that it ought not have. Children and the love of a husband, those are good things, but they are not as important as righteousness. And in both cases, they have gotten that out of perspective. Earlier, we saw Esau, and there it was an obvious disparity. Soup. He elevated soup to the thing that gives life, that it's life-giving, but its ultimate fulfillment, and sold the promises, the eternal promises of God, sold them cheap. Chris Hickey mentioned to me the other day, just reminded me of the parallel with Jesus in the temptations, where Satan came to him after he had been without food for 40 days, came to him and he said, change these stones to bread. I mean, this is easy. Change these stones to bread. Well, he was really hungry as opposed to Esau. And yet, Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So there are a lot of good things in the world, but it's important for us to understand how good they are. Where do they come in the priority of goods? And to adopt for our set of priorities the values of God himself, and to not get them out of order, not lose perspective. Jacob. Jacob is an interesting fellow because there's a sense in which he's got the Midas touch. And we'll see that as we proceed in the narrative, that everything he touches turns to gold, that he economically, he is blessed in everything that he does. He can't lose. Domestically, he can't do right. Domestically, he's got a mess on his hands. One of his problems is his favoritism. Just as his father had favored Esau over Jacob, as you will recall, Jacob now favors Rachel over Leah. Now, I understand fully that that was a difficult situation in which he got married to both Leah and Rachel. He never chose Leah. And I understand that. But still, he has a responsibility to Leah as a husband to love her. And it appears to me that Jacob has not done a good job of meeting that responsibility. He does not grant them both the respect that is due to them as his wives. Now, having said that, I realize what a difficult situation he's in. I mean, that's horrible. I don't understand how polygamy could possibly work. I mean, how can a husband treat two or more wives as being the most special thing in the world? It can't work. And I think that one of the points of this narrative is to indicate the fact that polygamy can't work. And we see the ramifications of polygamy. Nevertheless, realizing that Jacob is in a very difficult situation, and I don't know how one would cope with it wisely, nevertheless, I think it's clear he did not handle it wisely. And then Jacob makes some choices that only make matters worse. Having children through the maids, I think he should have known better. That only complicates matters. It doesn't fix it. And if I'm right in seeing, in understanding the narrative as indicating that he ceased to sleep with Leah for a period of time, that I think he made a wrong choice there as well. This is interesting because as we go on in Genesis, we will see that this competition between Rachel and Leah ultimately helps explain the tension that exists within Jacob's family, and it helps explain how Joseph gets almost killed, and short of being killed, is sold into slavery. So the mess that follows after this is all the legacy of this competition that it develops between Rachel and Leah, and I think is, in a sense, attributable to Jacob himself and the choices that he made. But in all of this, there is something else that's interesting. We're talking about the origins, the very origins of the nation of Israel, God's chosen people. And how is it that the 12 tribes of Israel come into being? They come into being as a result of this soap opera. They come into being as a result of petty motives, some silliness, some bad choices. All of that has gone into creating the 12 tribes of Israel. And I find something very reassuring about that. Because as we look about us, most of what we see is unrighteous choices, bad choices. And yet, out of that and through that, God is working his purposes. Nothing's spun out of control. God's going about doing what he had purposed to do. And things are right on time, right on track. Nothing has gone awry. It is very reassuring to me that God is able to take the wickedness that we do and use it for his redemptive purposes. He does that in our lives as individuals, and he does that in society as a whole. God is bringing about the purposes that he had originally intended. And he, in all of history, he is doing what he had foreshadowed in creation. In Genesis 1, it describes God's creation of the universe. And what is fascinating to me about that description is he starts out with darkness and chaos. And at the end, it's order and light. And I think that's prefiguring human history. It is dark. He takes the darkness and chaos of our lives, and what he's doing is he is shaping it into his purposes. He is creating order and light. And ultimately, that's what it will be. That's where he will get. So there's something very encouraging, I think, about that theme that we see developed here. Okay. There's not much time, but there's little time for questions and comments.
You didn't really comment much on Laban, and it seems when, you know, he seems so culpable in all this, he kind of got the ball rolling. Did you give any much thought to him? And he's Rebecca's brother who first came on the scene and with a quiet father there. And so did you give any thought to him at all?
No, not really. He doesn't figure into this particular section. He has done the work that has laid the ground for this, obviously, and the deception that he played on Jacob. It is interesting, though, that deception and trickery seems to be a significant part of Laban and his family, that family has developed that trait as a common trait among them. And Laban seems to be one of the best practitioners of that. And in that sense, he not only set up the situation that developed into this, he has also helped establish that pattern that then is followed by Rachel and Rebecca.
David, I've been listening to this sort of on the heels of going to the relationships and marriage classes on Tuesday nights at the study center. So this is so striking as far as how principled some of the subject matter is on Tuesday evenings, and juxtaposing that with Jacob coming in from the field and his wife saying, "Oh, by the way, I bought you tonight because I have these mandrake thing going." Mm-hmm. It's like there's not even a tinge of consciousness in this decision making. You know, he winds up being like a male prostitute almost. Mm-hmm. "Oh, you paid for me for tonight? Okay." So then, and you're jumping around with these handmaidens and stuff. And you touched on it the last section of what you were talking about. But is it because of the illumination that we have in the 21st century? And maybe you could speak on that a little more, about the growth of consciousness, so the subject matter that you guys have been tackling on Tuesday night is a refined vision of the history of the principles of our faith. When you're talking about intimacy like that, and Jack uses the example of a language and dissecting all this stuff, and yet you see this situation at the beginning of the nation of Israel as being just sort of this, it sounds more like 19th century Utah.
Yeah. Well, I am not inclined to think that that we have a significantly better understanding of marriage than was had at this time. Because if you look at I think it is clear that Abraham understood what it meant to love his wife. And we see him being devoted to her throughout his life. And I think there are a number of indications that that's the case. So there is someone back in those times that understood, I think, what marriage is all about. I think he really did understand that. But what we see is a phenomenon that's repeated time and time in history, that every generation has to discover it themselves. There's a sense in which it can be, to a degree, passed on. That's true. But there's another sense in which each generation has to find it themselves. And there are the clues out there, even apart from Scripture, there are the clues out there to understand what marriage must be all about. We are helped, I think, by Scripture. I think Scripture helps us to make sense of that and understand it. And that's all that we have done as far as the content in the Tuesday night classes, is just taken some of that material and put it into language. But I think there have been people that have discovered that and understood that throughout all of history. There are people who are students of life and students of God that have put those pieces together in every time period.
So if Jacob, let's do a hypothetical. If Jacob sat in on Tuesday night's classes, he would look back on, if this had happened maybe 3 years ago in his life, he would look back on that and say, this was just flat out evil. Or would he say, this was, I'm just bumbling through life and getting a nation started?
Well, aren't both? I think I'm going to take both options in a sense, because I think he made some wrong choices. I think that's really true. But who of us has not? I mean, one of the ways we come to wisdom is that bumbling process through which we make some wrong, even wicked choices. It's true. But we learn both from our own choices and hopefully from observing others. We gain wisdom and come to an understanding that I would hope that Jacob, in maturity, would be able to look at what he had done at this period of time and say, I made wrong choices. That I did not do what I was called upon by God to do as far as fulfilling my responsibilities as a husband. And would it help to have that laid out to him? To the extent that he is receptive to it, yes, it would help. To the extent that he's not receptive to it, no, it wouldn't help. One more. No, okay. Okay, let's, for the sake of those taking care of kids, we'll stop there.